Hey, this is Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Everything Fab 4 on Salon.com.
Welcome to Everything Fab 4, a podcast focused on fun and intelligent stories about the Beatles. I'm your host, Ken Womack, music culture columnist for Salon.com and a Beatles scholar and historian. No other band, or popular phenomenon for that matter, has enjoyed the global impact the Beatles have and continue to have more than 50 years later. They are part of our human fabric. They created music that continues to bring people together, and just about everyone has their own Beatles story to tell, some that are surprisingly deep and unexpected. This show seeks to draw those stories out in interesting and insightful ways. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.
Because when we hear the Beatles, that's when me and my son and my daughter are ready to dance and smile and be together as a family. That's when we're ready to say, you know, forget all the world. We are together in this most pure, beautiful space. And we're going to, as Kurt Vonnegut said, we're going to enjoy it and love each other no matter what, right now. And love our life right now, no matter what. We blow up a balloon and we keep it in the air and we turn on Here Comes the Sun or whatever Beatles song.
Today's guest is Sophie B. Hawkins, a Grammy-nominated American singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and painter. Born and raised in New York City, she pursued her studies as a percussionist at the Manhattan School of Music before embarking on a music career. Hawkins exploded into the international consciousness in 1992 with her debut album, Tongues and Tails. A massive critical and commercial success, the LP spawned the hit single, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. Her second album, Wailer, featured additional hit singles in Right Beside You and As I Lay Me Down. Career highlights include her 1992 appearance at the 30th anniversary concert celebration, honoring Bob Dylan's career, for which Hawkins performed a cover version of I Want You. As an actress, she has portrayed Janis Joplin in the play Room 105, while also performing as herself on the NBC TV series Community, for which she sang renditions of Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover and As I Lay Me Down. After Sony delayed the release of her third album, Timbre, Hawkins established the independent label Trumpet Swan Productions. Her latest album, Free Myself, features such standout tracks as Love Yourself and Better Off Without You. Hawkins is a tireless supporter of issues related to animal rights and the environment. As a political activist, she is a longtime proponent of LGBT rights. Welcome, Sophie B. Hawkins. So, were you from a musical family?
Well, the one musical person in my family was my grandmother, Grandma Hawkins, and she actually went to Smith at a time when women didn't go to college. She's from Vermont, and before that, from Scotland. And then she did go to a musical college for a minute, but she didn't pursue it so much. She got married to my grandfather, but she always had a piano, and she was always trying to get all her grandkids into lessons. However, and I think this helped in the end, our parents didn't want us to be taken to lessons because they thought that overbearing hand of the grandparents would ruin us. They wanted us to be free because they grew up with the Beatles. They grew up listening to the Beatles and the Stones and the Dylan, and they just thought that we should find our own path and shouldn't be regulated and guided by grown-ups. So we didn't go to lessons. So I did have a musical grandmother, but she didn't get to impart her love of music onto me, although I did find it eventually, of course.
So then what's the road that takes you from those early days with Grandma Hawkins? And I just flashed on Annie Hall, right? Grammy Hall.
That's really cute.
How did you go from, you know, the supportive but free Grandma Hawkins to becoming a multi-instrumentalist?
Well, I mean, I did get to do one lesson. Grandma got one lesson in there when I was six. And the piano teacher that she took me to said I was really talented. And even though my grandmother never came back to take us to lessons, and even though I didn't get to pursue it then, when I was 14 years old, I said to my aunt, Linda, I'm going to be an African drummer. Do you know any African drum teachers? And she said, yes, I do. I know an African drum teacher. And that in itself is just so weird, because here we are, two, you know, whiter than white women sitting on the couch in Manhattan. And she's saying, yes, she knows an African drum teacher. And she did. So she got me to her friend who was an African drum teacher. And that really did change the course of my life. Also because I wanted it. Like I said, this is what I want. And then when he gave me my first lesson, I decided to quit basketball and just only do African drums with him. And that led to percussion and drum set. And that led to Manhattan School of Music, which, you know, opened the doors for piano and sight singing and theory and all of it. And so my drum teacher, he was a multi-instrumentalist, and he would never let me just get away with playing the drums.
So first of all, Grandma Hawkins has amazing connections.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, and then secondly, so what drew you to have that moment of epiphany where you thought, I want to be an African drummer?
Well, I would theorize on the most practical level that there was a lot of African drummers in Central Park, and I loved listening to them, and I spent all my time in Central Park as a kid. The other thing is, drums are the most, you know, they're the first door to opening up storytelling, and songwriting is storytelling. And I ultimately did always want to be a songwriter because I loved songs. I never cared about the singer so much. I didn't really, you know, yeah, I was always in love with the song. I wanted to be a song. So drums seemed to be the best way. It just is unconscious, these things. I could make up a reason why I chose African drums, but I think it goes back to something so much in the psyche, something unconscious.
That's right. And something when you were a kid, you know, we do that when we're free, yeah. Right? And we allow things to independently come into our sort of ecosystems. So you went from the drums. How does the drums then, what were your instruments that you picked up after that?
Well, so this African drum teacher brought over a marimba, and then I learned to play Blue Skies by Hoagie Carmichael on the marimba. And then I learned the vibraphone, and I got really into jazz because I love the sustain of the vibraphone. You know, I could hold my foot down and just do these beautiful ethereal chords and melodies. So I got into improvising, and then, of course, I would be sitting down at my drum teacher's piano because he lived on 74th Street in the Ansonia. So I'd go to his house, and he would encourage me to sit down at the piano. So basically, it was natural. Like, I wasn't actually that good a drummer, to be totally honest with you. I practiced all the time, and I wanted to be more natural than I was, but I was a natural composer type, like where I got theory really quickly. I got movement and structure and story really quickly. So maybe that's how. It's just wanting to fill it in, wanting to play the guitar and the bass to be able to be more a part of the creative process.
That makes sense, because then you can tell more of the story. It's sort of like having more moves as a writer, right? The more instruments you have, the more ability you have to paint a deeper picture.
Yes, and I think one of the great things is opening up the unconscious. And when you pick up an instrument you don't know how to play, you're more likely to find that amazing melody, that amazing lyric. When you've played an instrument so much, you tend to go back to the same old thing. And so in that sense, like why I picked up the banjo and wrote Lose Your Way on the banjo was because I was looking for something new, and it did happen. It does happen.
That's cool. And now you mentioned jazz, and I remember vividly the first time I heard Damn, I Wish You Was My Lover, that I could hear a jazz sound in that song when it started taking the airwaves in the early 1990s. I could hear this kind of jazz sound. Can you tell us about the jazz part of your background?
Yeah. First of all, I'm really complimented that you did hear that, because it's true. It's not only in the chords, it's in the melody. It's in the way that the melody keeps changing. It's in the way that there's no chorus the same. There's three choruses in that song, and each one is actually different. It's amazing that you picked it up, because most people don't. So I like that you did that. So my jazz background, well, you know, I grew up in Manhattan. My father loved jazz. He listened to jazz till 4 and 5 in the morning, and even on weeknights, he'd sit there with his scotch and his cigarette in the living room. I don't know how he got to work the next morning, but he always did. My mother was more like, you know, my mother loved Joan Baez. She loved the Stones. So it fit in. Like, we had the great songwriters of the 60s and 70s, and then we had the great jazz artists, from Billie Holiday to Ornette Coleman to, you know, everybody, Elvin Jones, everybody was playing in my house, you know, via the record player. So that was just that. I absorbed it. I wasn't conscious of it. I loved it. I absorbed it. And then when I started going to clubs at 14 years old, which is what we did then, we would go out on school nights and we'd go to like Tramps. We'd go to McKell's. We'd go to all the famous jazz clubs. We being me and my drum teacher. And then I absorbed it that way, by seeing it, hearing it, and feeling really confident that I understood it. And then again, as I told you, I played the marimba and the vibes, and I was into it. I practiced all the time. And then it got to the point where I was transcribing Elvin Jones. Because I don't know if you know anything about Elvin Jones, but that's a lot of notes. And I even transcribed his grunts. I was so into it. Like, I wanted to understand. And I did the same thing with songwriters. Like, I would not only write out the melody and the chords, and write out the rhythms, because I felt like that was part of what was making the song a hit. I wanted to know what made this music so beautiful.
All those elements.
Yes.
You know, I remember one of the things, in addition to the jazz elements, is that I liked about the song was just that it was different. You know, after the 80s, where things were starting to become a little rote and a little robotic, it was just so refreshing, which is often how people talk about the Beatles. Now, when did you have your Beatles origin moment? When did they appear in your world?
Well, I think the first album that I remember, like, sitting in the living room in Manhattan with playing the Beatles on the record player, and actually reading, looking at all the pictures and reading all the liner notes. I'm trying to remember, but I think that was Revolver. And it's not that it was that year. It was that was when, probably at 6 years old, I said, oh, this is so cool. This sounds so good. And you know, when you're a kid, and maybe it's not the same for kids now because of the digital, the way that they receive music. But for me back then, the fact that there was this central place where we heard the music on the record player in the house, where everybody played their favorite records at different times, mm-hmm. It was like they were a part of the family. So I felt the Beatles were very close to my family because we loved them so much. So that they were sort of in our family. It's really sweet in the way it was totally a child vision of it. So I don't know. What's the one where they're looking down from the apartment building? It's blue.
Oh, that's actually the EMI office building. That's Please Please Me would be the U.S. The UK version. So you and I are close to the same age, and it would have been it could have been those greatest hits albums from the 1970s, the 1962, 66, and 1967, 70, the red and blue albums.
Yeah, that could be, because I do remember very much like the cover of Revolver, but I remember the looking down that, what I just said, I remember that really clearly too when I was young, looking at that and listening. And again, you know, an apartment building. I grew up in Manhattan. I just related to them. And then knowing that John Lennon at some point when it came into my consciousness that he lived right down the street, you know, in the Dakota, that all these things were so close. And so, but basically it was the music. It was the fact that we could sing every part. And that is the thing I like about the Beatles too, by the way. I like that even as a non-musician, you can sing basically every part from the bass, and you can pretend to be Ringo. You can actually hear what he's playing. You can imitate it on the cushions and all that. And when we were kids, we didn't know that we weren't playing along, even though we were playing on tennis rackets and couch cushions. We still thought we were playing along.
The magic of our childhood psyches, right?
Yes. But then come to think that, you know, who knows, maybe that it, you know, here I am giving my daughter violin lessons and she'll probably end up rebelling and saying, I hate violin, it's too serious, you know. But the thing is, who knows, maybe that is the best way to teach music or to share music. Maybe it is to not put an instrument in someone's face. And maybe it is to let them just enjoy the music and pretend, you know, it's just, I think of this now and it's a thought I've never thought of before, but maybe all that was what gave me the confidence and the lack of tension around music.
Oh, so maybe Grandma Hawkins knew what she was doing.
Yeah, so maybe the lack of lessons and the lack of pressure and the fun of playing along on our own terms without real instruments made us feel a part of something that was magical and beautiful. And that's sort of the way I feel on stage. Every time we get up there, I feel like this is crazy magical and beautiful. And I can see it in the people's faces in the audience too. And there's something that I go, I just can't believe this is my job, to be honest with you.
So when did you begin, obviously quite young from your previous comments, when did you begin thinking, I want to be a songwriter, and when did you begin putting that in action?
Well, I wanted to be a song. And then at some point, I realized I had to be a songwriter. And at some point, the consciousness became, oh, I'm not a song? Oh, shoot. And I better write a song. It was weird that really birthed in. You know, the feeling is that when you're, before you're a teenager, you're a part of everything. And then when you're a teenager, you're like sort of a part of nothing unless you make it happen, which is so depressing and difficult. So I think maybe my very late teens, I realized I wanted to be a songwriter, but I wanted to keep studying more music. That was when I was studying, trying to get into Manhattan School of Music. Then sometime in the second year of Manhattan School of Music, I started writing lyrics on the wall. I was just frustrated and I didn't want to be a drummer anymore. I wanted to be a songwriter and I didn't know how to go about it. So I just started to do it, you know, like in a weird way, like writing lyrics on a wall. And then I would join bands as a drummer and I would try to get my songs in the set. It wasn't so easy, really, the transition. It took a lot of psychic push on my part.
I do love the notion, by the way, of being a song before a songwriter, right? That's so magical. When you would think you wanted to be a song, what did you mean?
Well, like, when my father would play Positively 4th Street, he'd say, don't you just love that lyric? And I think I love everything about this. I love my father. I love New York. I love the view out the window. I love the song. And that it seemed like the song had everything that was in it. The song encapsulated the whole moment, which is a lot how people think about songs. Because they hear a song and it brings out a whole moment, a whole memory, a whole, you know, a dream. And so that's what I wanted to be, that. What was happening then.
And that's right.
And the song held it up within it.
And it's so fascinating the way, you know, as we've already discussed, songs have elements and they have very particular instruments to play on them, vocalists, et cetera, lyrics. But then there's that whole dimension where a song belongs to somebody in a moment that we're not part of.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, do you ever think about your own songs in that way, that folks must have their building connective tissue and memories out of the music that you put out there?
Yes. Yes. And that's what I meant to mention when I see it on the, when I'm sitting or standing rather and singing, and I see it in people's faces that the song represents something in their life that is like their own. And they're allowing me to bring it back, and they're sharing it with me in that moment. It's kind of powerful. And, you know, it's also why I can't stand when people ask me what my songs are about, or they label my songs or label me, because there is a point even in me where it's a connective tissue to something bigger and something more profound than I can express. And it doesn't go back to, I wrote this about so-and-so, or it's a something song and it's a something song. We don't know how we get to do what we do. Artists are people, basically, I think, who are able to stop thinking about it long enough to let the creations out. We all have the potential to do it, but people don't let themselves, or they don't want to, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but for me, that thing that happens for other people with a song also happens with me. And it's not related to a person, place, or thing. It's related to something bigger than that, that may include a person, place, and a thing at one point, but that's just a trigger point. The rest is bigger.
We'll be back with more from Sophie B. Hawkins after these messages.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to Everything Fab 4 on Salon.com.
I'd like to share what I think is one of the most profound statements ever made about the Beatles, and I'm proud to note that you, Sophie B. Hawkins, made it. So, without further ado, I'd like to read it for our listeners and then get your comments about really this very insightful collection of thoughts.
You said the Beatles defined their own sense of value and honor. They took stances without ever being politically correct, and they did it all with incredible humor. I honestly think that there are certain things in life that help people understand themselves. I think the Beatles are one of those things. They resonate the journey of true selfhood, really.
Okay, I said that?
You did.
Amazing. Did I say it like in a moment, or did I write it down?
I believe you wrote it down, and it is beautiful. And it's right up there for me with the really remarkable and insightful quote from Kurt Vonnegut about how the Beatles made him enjoy life more.
God, that's that. Well, see, Kurt Vonnegut said it better in a way, because that is everything I'm trying to say, but he said it simpler.
Oh, no. See, I'm going to argue with you. I think Hawkins takes out Vonnegut here. There are certain things in life that help people understand themselves. I think the Beatles are one of those things. They resonate the journey of true selfhood, really. That's you. I love that. And I wonder if you could tell us more about what makes you feel that way about them, and why they are different, which I guess is why people are still listening to them 60 years later.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can better what you read back to me. I don't know if I can say anything better. But the thing that when you're telling me that, it makes me cry, because it just makes me feel like it, to expand upon it, like literally expand, like Einstein said, expanding your circle of compassion. The fact that you can do that in a group of people also, like I said, the Beatles were a part of my family. The fact that my family got to experience in all those individual things together is also an amazing thing. And I think the Beatles as individuals got to do it together. Where, wow, humans rarely do this. Where together, they were so huge, and they were able to sustain that it like held them until it didn't. I guess the time was up for that. But the thing is that we all got to expand in that same way, this togetherness around them. I have never had that with another artist. And you know, when I hear like Bowie, and my son loves Bowie, and I loved Bowie later on in life. I got a little older, and then I wanted to listen to David Bowie and everything. And I see, but you know, we can't share it in the same way we share the Beatles. Because when we feel the Beatles, that's when me and my son and my daughter are ready to dance and smile and be together as a family. That's when we're ready to say, you know, forget all the world. We are together in this most pure, beautiful space. And we're going to, as Kurt Vonnegut said, we're going to enjoy it and love each other no matter what, right now. And love our life right now, no matter what. We blow up a balloon and we keep it in the air and we turn on Here Comes the Sun or whatever Beatles song. We can't do that with Bowie. You know what I mean? There's a real difference. We can't even do that really with the Stones. But you can do it always with the Beatles. Always with anyone. Isn't that shocking?
It's beautiful, and it's true, right? Because in a way, Bowie demands to be listened to differently. And of course, their journey is remarkable in so many ways. One, that they stayed together as long as they could. But secondly, of course, because they change so much. You know, they start off with those very simple show tune like songs like She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, and they're ending up with the Abbey Road medley. You know, that's a journey.
It is. And when I think of I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I think about it often because it, to me, that defines when you want to marry somebody. When I think about how simple I Want to Hold Your Hand is, but it's taken me almost 60 years to understand that that actually is the essence of wanting to really be with somebody in this eternal way. It is about wanting to hold their hand, because I don't know if you feel this way, but for me, if I want to hold someone's hand, that is the most intimate thing I could possibly do.
Because of personal space and connection and those sorts of things?
It's like, for me, it reassures me that this person and I have each other's back, and that we are, it's the nobility of holding someone's hand. It's so strong. When you hold someone's hand, you're saying, I've got you and I'm here for you no matter what. And that has happened to me twice besides my children, or maybe even once with a human being. And, you know, of course it's my sort of task, not that I'm testing people, but if I want to hold someone's hand, then holding their hand is the thing that feels so good. Then I say, just go with it. Trust your gut, because the hand and the heart are it.
That's powerful. And I love the idea that the person whose hand you're holding, they're in your corner, right? That's the person that you trust the most. That's powerful. Did the Beatles, did they inform your songwriting in any way in terms of how you go about it? I mean, I confessed to hearing jazz earlier, and that may be one of the areas where the Beatles have less truck, as it were. Did they impact your songwriting?
Yeah, they did, but I can't say exactly how. But just in wanting to be the best, like never settling. I know when one of my songs is mediocre, and I won't allow myself to stop working on it until I feel it has that mystery, that magic, like that has like something. I always say something because I'm not sure what something is about, the song. I'm not sure what it's really about, but I have there's a sense of magic to it. And then for me, until I hit that point of magic with a song, I don't want to let it go. And I don't always get it, but I try. And so when I put a song on an album, it has to have lived with me for a while, and it has to have some sense of magic and mystery, and often the humor. The thing about the Beatles also that has informed my songwriting is their humor and their lyrics and the way you just laugh out loud when you listen to them, and that people don't laugh enough at my songs, which makes me feel like I haven't really achieved it, because when I listen to my songs, sometimes I laugh out loud. Maybe people do and I don't know it. But that is a really great song when you can actually be moved and laugh at the funniness of a lyric, the turn of a phrase. That's amazing.
Feeling 2 foot small or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, and Baby, You Can Drive My Car. The lyrics are just, everything is, they're just so often so funny.
Baby, You're a Rich Man.
Yes. Oh, man. And they're funny to different people for different reasons. So, yes, we have to know that they've influenced me because I grew up on them as if they were the food I was eating, you know?
So it's in the air.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could, full confession, I've done my research and I read about your composition of this well-known song, but I wonder if you could share with our listeners how you wrote Damn, I Was Your Lover, because it's an interesting story about creativity and the magic of it.
You mean like the mistake of it?
Sure.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, I'll often be at the piano or the whatever instrument, and then it will be late and I'll be tired. And I realize that until I get to the point of tiredness, I won't find that magical simplicity of a lyric or a chord, something. And my hands were going back, you know, from the A to the D chord, and it was beautiful. But then I was so tired that my hand slipped to the G. So it was D to A over G, and suddenly that was the sound, the jazz sound that you said, but it opened up my heart and it opened up the lyrics. So it was a mistake of my hand, and that it was a big sound, and it is a big sound. Every time that song is played and you hear those opening chords, you go, that's big. And that was a big fucking accident. I am sorry I cursed. That was a big freaking accident. But the bigness of it made me say, here it comes. I know it's coming. Oh my God. What am I going to do? I just have to sit here and let it come out. And it did. And it was big.
That's beautiful.
And I had to follow it. Yeah.
That reminds me of the beautiful origin story. I guess it was in Jane Asher's basement or somewhere, where John and Paul were on the piano and they were playing I Want to Hold Your Hand, and they looked at each other because it suddenly felt big. It was bigger than they were in the room, right?
Yes, that is. That is it. Yes.
One of the things I enjoyed about experiencing your career was, you know, I adored that song and purchased the first album, you know, good fan that I was. And then you came back with what felt like a very different kind of song. And, you know, again, after the 80s, which felt so rote to me, it was nice to see someone who wasn't doing the same trick over and over again, right? I mean, like, I love the band The Cars, but they didn't really, at a certain point, they didn't move outside of their range very much, right?
And I
remember hearing As I Lay Me Down and thought, wow, this is completely different. you know, it felt more like a lullaby that I just had to have, but it just felt different. I mean, how did that song come about?
Well, you know, that's another way the Beatles must have influenced me subconsciously, because they had such a range. So I guess I expected it of myself, you know, growing up, then that I would have to have that kind of range and push myself. Well, yeah, you know, As I Lay Me Down came out, you know, Damn was very pure. It came out in this very pure way. I didn't want to sound like anything. I wasn't looking particularly to imitate anything. I really wanted to express these feelings that Damn expresses. And when the music came and it became the vehicle, I followed it. And I told you it was somewhat terrifying because it was so big and so truthful. And boy, did I keep going with the truth in that song. It's just like one verse after another gets more and more revealing in a way. Mm-hmm. So with As I, that was something where, again, I was tired. I was a waitress. It wasn't that long after Damn. But all of these were before I was signed. And then I remember leaning against a bedpost, sitting on a floor, leaning against a bedpost after I had been waiting tables all night. And this guitar, my classical first guitar, and it didn't come out like, it wasn't it was more like a classical thing. It sounded like it, like the As I Lay Me Down chorus came out. It started to come out almost like I was being led, very different than Dan. It was almost as though it were written in my mind and was now coming out. Like all I had to do was just let it come out. And it went right to that verse. And boy, the bridge, are you kidding me? That bridge, people still say, every musician, when they play that bridge, says, I cannot believe this bridge. And I think to myself, I can't believe it either, but it happened. I was there. It just was, I was almost led. And probably what happened is that I had been playing the guitar for so many weeks, going through so many different variations, that it just came together, like the puzzle came together. But in the moment, it felt like it was just coming out, you know?
That's
and beautiful. That was really a clear emotion, too. I had the clear emotion, very different than Dan, about a very different part of my life. But the very clear emotion was there, and the very clear emotion is in the song, clearly. I mean, that is so pure.
Well, so flash forward then, and you have a new album. I wonder if you could tell me about the making of that new record and the experiences with going back into the studio.
Well, the new album, I really love the new album. And I have to say, I didn't always love it. But again, I sit with my songs a really long time before I let them out or let people hear them, because I want to make sure that I just want to see how they age a little bit, you know, within my consciousness. So I did sit with those songs a while, and then they kept, you know, more kept coming. But some of them I didn't let out for a really long time. And then when I got into the studio with Ken Rich in Brooklyn, I had a lot of songs, you know, that I said, look, here's 50 songs. Let's just choose the 12 best or whatever. So it was a process of really, and then going back and forth. But what was fun about it was I always have my demos. And my demos are really clear, pure versions of the song, you know, and sometimes I'll do two or three demos, different keys, different arrangements, whatever, because I want to see if the song is any good. So I sat there with Ken and we were like, well, for instance, the song Free Myself, just as an example, was very musical. It was like strings. My demo had strings and timpani and it was just so musical. It was in a much higher key and it sounded like it was written for literally a musical. And he said, you know, I just wonder what it would be like if we just the same exact song, but maybe tried it on like a more flamenco-y guitar. And so it was that kind of thing. Like, let's just see what we can. And it didn't happen with every song, but that, and I happened to love the way Free Myself came out. Now I did mourn the old version and I still have the old demo because it was so dramatic. Free Myself, it was just so, so dramatic, the demo. But the album version is very simple and sweet, and it goes the same places musically, but it's so much more it's so understated. So anyways, that's the kind of thing that happened with this album.
So then what do you do when you know that this other version of this song that you're happy with, of course,
yes.
But this other version of this song exists? I mean, does it ever see the light of day? What happens? Or is it just part of the archival history of that particular
company? Well, I always hope that I will have a chance to put out my demos, you know, as sort of a work of art, because I do think, you know, like I have the 20 demos of Dan, I Wish I Was Your Lover, and the very first one is really beautiful. But in a way, people have to really, it's like it has to be a thing, because demos are very sacred. You know, yes, I would love to put them out, but I don't want to put them out and expect, it's not like marketing an album. It would be like, I guess, a coffee table book of someone's work after a long period of time where they really have arrived. Like when you see Annie Leibovitz's coffee table books, it's because she's gotten there. She's gotten there in her career. And I think with my demos, they're so, so deep to me and they're so precious that I would like to have gotten there. And then people listen to them and like, this is special. This is a gift for you, a personal thing, you know? And then people who get it will really get it. And a lot of people will go, I don't really get that. It's too simple, or that's too sparse, or that's just strange. There's strange animals demos, you know?
I like that.
Not everyone understands them.
I've been listening to lately the demos of the band Badfinger. Remember those guys from the early 70s?
Yes.
And they're really, you know, despite in addition to knowing how the tragedy of that band, but they're really haunting. They're just different stories, you know. Before they put on their power pop guitars and completely change them, they're these little haunting stories, and it does, you know, it is a very different experience. Like you said, they are kind of a gift, aren't they?
They are. And you know, the few people who hear my demos, they say that. They say it's like a Christmas thing. And some people aren't really equipped to hear them. They can't strip down and just hear something for what it is. The same way they can't see the brilliance in a child's artwork. You know, they think, well, his, you know, that child hasn't studied, that, you know, they don't get it. And I get it. So I'm going to say, you're not going to judge my child's artwork, and you're not going to judge my demos, because I treasure them so much. Like I said, they're like creatures from another place. And it's so sweet. And you know what's really interesting too? It's like with my paintings for me, I don't market them. I'm not marketing my demos. I'm actually marketing an album. And there's a process when you're going to market yourself. The process, it starts, and then you have a beginning and a middle and an end. And you know when you're ready to market something. And you talked about Free Myself. Do you know that this album was ready before the pandemic, but no one in the business thought it was ready? And it's the exact same album. And then one person at the end of the pandemic said, well, what have you really been doing? Why is it taking you so long? And I go, well, I've been doing so much, but nobody likes it. And so he said, let me hear it. And he goes, what? This is beautiful. Why aren't you letting this out? And I said, well, nobody wants to support it. And I don't want to do crowdfunding because it's too much work for me. I mean, I know I'll never follow through on crowdfunding personally because I don't go online. You know? So how am I going to do that? So it was just like one person. And then, so it's the way people hear things. And maybe that's like, ultimately, it does go back to the Beatles. It's the way you let something in. And we humans have let the Beatles in to the purest part of us. We trust them. We trust them. We don't trust everybody. And we don't always want to hear every kind of artist. But for sometimes, you know, with the Beatles, you know, you can trust and you can let them in. Why is that? It's really intimate.
That's such a great question. And I think about these very things a lot, of course. I teach them every fall here on the Jersey Shore. And I think about this question a lot because I have the privilege of watching students sometimes have their first Beatle experiences, right? Where they connect with them. And I go back to your beautiful quotation from a moment ago. I mean, they let us in. They let us into their journey, but they also stimulate our own journey, right?
Yeah. You
know, they let us know that it's okay to have our hearts broken. And I mean, heck, that we should want to have our hearts broken, right? because that's part of the emotional lived experience. And I don't know about you, but in some of my darkest times, I've thought, you know what? This is a really terrible time I'm in right now, but I wouldn't trade the Beatles for any of this. And thank goodness they're here.
Yeah. They didn't really exploit us as an audience.
Yeah, that's right. We could, you are loaded with pithy quotes.
I don't know how this happens, but it just is like, it comes from my unconscious.
Yeah. They invite us along for that ride, and they don't exploit us or force us to go on it. But you know, damn, if not every time I play the White Album, I realize there's a space in there for me, right?
Yes.
Everything Fab 4 is presented by Salon.com. the premier news, politics, innovation, and arts website. For more information, visit everythingfab4.com, where you can learn more about our podcast and my latest Beatles-related books, including John Lennon 1980, The Last Days in the Life, and a forthcoming biography about beloved Beatles roadie Mal Evans. The Everything Fab 4 theme song, Seize the Day, is provided courtesy of Black Rabbit, the high-octane Beatles cover band and innovative psychedelic rock project from Rockaway Beach, Queens, in New York City. Like what you heard today on Everything Fab 4? Be sure to subscribe, give us a rating, and recommend the show to your friends. Plus, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at EF4 Podcast. Distributed by Salon, Everything Fab 4 is a Wonderwall production. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.